Kilmeade and Friends coming your way. One of our great friends, Ambassador John Bolton, joins us, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. And I imagine if Mitt Romney does become president, he's going to have a role. He has a lot of respect for the ambassador, as we do. Ambassador, I'm just concerned. The leak investigation that was supposed to at least stop future leaks has actually not scared anybody away from leaking out top secret information that the CIA is helping Syrian rebels. How does that happen?
Yeah, it's really unbelievable, and just adds one more piece of evidence to all those who have said that the series of leaks is unprecedented and really can only come from the very top of the administration. These leaks form too clear a pattern. And, you know, the administration was under criticism for not doing anything about the conflict in Syria. And suddenly a highly classified intelligence finding is on the front pages of the newspapers. It's as the communists used to say, it's no accident, comrade.
And on top of that, there's another leak coming out about what we're doing with Israel, trying to make sure that they don't have plans to attack. And they're relieved that they don't have imminent plans to attack, that they'll wait or not wait. Why are we even getting this? We just watched Panetta and Donlin all go over there in some type of panic.
Well, I think, unfortunately, it's all of a piece. It's the politicization of national security. Look, every president considers the politics of national security decisions. It just goes with the territory. But this administration, I think, is unique, unfortunately, in our history, in that the politics seem to them to be more important than the national security. The administration is absolutely distraught at the prospect that Israel might act in self-defense against the ever more threatening Iranian nuclear weapons program, and they're trying to talk them out of it or at least get them past November the 6th, and therefore leaking what they're saying, leaking what the situation is, spun all to the administration's advantage is part of their game plan. I just, as I say, it's unprecedented, extraordinarily unfortunate for the United States and its allies.
Let me ask you something. Do you think that Mitt Romney was being somewhat clumsy in diplomatic terms in saying, "Hey, we're going to move the capital. If I have my say, we're going to move our embassy over to Jerusalem. And by the way, it's the Jewish culture, the Israeli culture, that allows you guys to thrive." Is that something people think but don't say?
Well, no, I think actually that two separate issues, but he was actually saying something that's uncontroversial until the mainstream media get their hands on it. Let's take the Jerusalem thing first. Every American administration up until the Obama administration has acknowledged that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. Of course it's the capital. It's where the key government agencies are, other than the Ministry of Defense, which is back in Tel Aviv, in effect to get it away from the front line, which is where Jerusalem is. All of the Israeli government offices are in West Jerusalem, behind the Green Line. There has never been any contention that any of the territory on what they currently sit would ever go to the Palestinians if the two-state solution came about. The issue has been not what is the capital of Israel, but where should the American embassy be?
Right.
And Congress some years ago passed a statute saying, you know, it might make sense to put our embassy in the capital. The State Department bureaucracy has resisted year after year, and successive administrations have said, we're going to waive that statute. We're not going to move the embassy. Romney simply said what I think should have been done a long time ago, that he will actually comply with the legislation because it's the right thing to do to have your embassy in the capital city of the country to which your ambassador is accredited.
All right, I got to bring it back to the Syria situation. Kofi Annan quits. He says he blames a lot of the powers in the area for not getting along with the United Nations. For one thing, what has Kofi Annan ever done successfully?
Well, you know, he's proven he has something in common with Barack Obama. It's always everybody else's fault. It had nothing to do with his failures on this mission. But, you know, the most basic failure is he kept pointing the finger at this thing called the international community, he kept saying the international community has to come together. There is no international community. There are 193 members of the UN. They each pursue their own interest. And pursuing that illusion, I think, cost us opportunities in the Syrian context. And he and that theology that there is an international community that means something are partly to blame for this. So I don't have any sympathy for his complaints.
Ambassador, it shouldn't surprise you. The Russians are blaming us. They're getting more bold by the day. They say the U.S. is to blame because we only encourage one side, and that is the rebels. We didn't try to see Assad's side. I paraphrase here.
No, look, I think the whole Kofi Annan mediation mission was a ploy by the Russians. The Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, was their ambassador at the UN for over 15 years. He knows the system well. He knows Kofi Annan well. He knew once the UN Security Council deployed Kofi Annan, they were buying time for the Assad regime. And what the Russians hoped was that Assad would be able to crush the opposition during that time. They were wrong on that, but they sure bought a lot of time. That's why the Russians regret Kofi Annan resigning. They'd like to see him stay in there and keep trying, because it would buy the Assad regime even more time.
I mean, you just very simply say this. We would have gotten something done at the United Nations if it wasn't for China and Russia. How America gets blamed is unbelievable. We do nothing, we get blamed. We do too much, we get blamed. But it is now... We're sitting on the sidelines and getting blamed.
Well, you talk about culture. Yeah, you talk about culture. This is the culture of the United Nations. It's moral equivalence. It's everybody's to blame. Nobody does any worse or any better than anybody else. And that's the universe Kofi Annan lives in.
Well, I hope he's out for good. I don't want to see him trying to solve anything because he never gets anything done. He's absolutely useless, overrated, and doesn't deserve any of those medals. Ambassador, I'm watching a great report on another network about the sophistication of the Haqqani network. They actually have mini models of a lot of our Afghan bases. They have very sophisticated suicide bombing runs that they rehearse and rehearse. They have sophisticated equipment now. Great. They have camouflage uniforms. We have allowed that through two administrations to exist. Do you believe that we will leave Afghanistan and the Haqqani network intact?
I believe if Barack Obama is reelected, he's made it very clear that's exactly what he intends to do, and it would sacrifice everything that we've wanted, such a high human cost for our service members in Afghanistan the last 10 years, high financial cost. The president's just about to give that all away. And I think even more important, that kind of evidence undercuts the whole narrative that, you know, the war on terrorism, basically over. We've basically won. Osama bin Laden is dead. What's to worry about? It's not true. The terrorists may be a more distributed network, as they say today, but they're growing strength in many parts of the world, including in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Are you going to tell me that Al-Qaeda can't set up shop somewhere now in Egypt? Of course they can.
Zawahiri,
one of the founders of the Muslim Brotherhood, is one of the co-founders of Al-Qaeda. And by the way, he stays alive and well. They're part of the insurgency in Syria, sadly. They played a role in Libya, sadly. And they're strong in Iraq again, as they seem to have reconfigured themselves.
Al-Qaeda re-emerging in Iraq. No doubt about it.
And now we look at Iran. And Iran, I thought Israel said something very profound. They said, look out, Iran, sometime in the next 12 weeks. Why 12 weeks?
Well, there's a lot of speculation about weather conditions in the Middle East and whether if Israel is going to take that step many have anticipated of striking Iran's nuclear weapons program, they're going to try and do it when weather conditions over Iran would be optimal, and that's before the winter season begins. That's speculation, of course, but the weather's there for everybody to look at.
And we now have Ahmadinejad. We know he's not running things per se over there, but he's got a high-ranking position. He's calling for the annihilation of Israel.
Yeah, look, he says what everybody in the top leadership in Tehran believes. They've said it many times before. And, you know, when you do strategic analysis, conceptually it's not that hard. You look at intentions and you look at capabilities. Ahmadinejad, I think, is stating what the Iranian leadership's intentions are. And if they get nuclear weapons, they'll have the capabilities. So they have what they would need if they wanted to do precisely what he's saying, which is annihilate the state of Israel.
Are there people within the State Department that you keep in touch with that also feel the frustration that I feel and you feel?
Well, there are. I certainly wouldn't want to do too much to identify them in the current administration, though.
But, I mean, you talk to people and they are throwing up their hands?
Well, I think there's a lot of frustration across not just the State Department, but the Defense Department, the intelligence community, everybody who deals with national security, at the increasing weakness of the administration, its refusal to deal with challenges to American interests, challenges to our friends around the world. And, you know, obviously the economy is the prime issue here politically in the United States. But our adversaries are not being gracious enough for us to get our to wait to get our economic house in order. These challenges are mounting, and either Obama needs to deal with him, or if Mitt Romney is elected, he's going to have a lot on his plate on January the 20th.
You know, we might be in the position of trying to save the Alawites because they've killed 19,000 people. The rebels have killed some, too. And they're going to go down. Within the next few months, they're going to go down. And then we're going to have to protect them against the Sunnis, I guess, or just allow them to be slaughtered.
Well,
what should America's role be?
This is one of the reasons I've been reluctant to aid the opposition from the beginning. We just don't know who the opposition leaders are or who we can trust. There's no defense you can make for Assad and his regime and the horrors that they've inflicted on Syria during the decades they've been in power. But precisely for that reason, it's not an excuse. It's a reality.
But don't we have profiles of the defectors, some high-ranking government officials who are now
some,
in other countries?
We know some, but we don't know whether they're any more popular in Syria than you and I are. And that's the trouble, because the risk is that the Sunnis, after facing the massacres they faced, will take it out on the Alawites, the Christians, the Druze. Nobody's justified in doing that, but you can understand, given the background, why it might happen. And I think the last thing any of us should want is American weapons used in a bloodbath.
Now, I got to ask you something. Have you heard the report that the former Saudi ambassador to the U.S. turned intelligence chief has been assassinated?
Well, you know, I saw that, but I haven't seen it picked up anywhere else. You know, Bandar is a colorful figure, let's put it that way, and I'm sure if he's still alive, we'll see him soon enough.
But if not, if he was in fact assassinated, all fingers would point to Syria or Iran, correct?
No, absolutely. Look, the tensions between Iran and Iran's surrogates in Syria, Hezbollah, the terrorist group in Lebanon on the one hand, and Saudi and the other Sunni Arabs on the other are very high. If Iran or one of its surrogates took out as senior a figure as Prince Bandar, that would mark a dramatic escalation in tension in the region. Dramatic.
The Saudis would look for direct military confrontation, and the word is they're so far looking at military options or too stunned to react. That's how much he means to that government.
Look, he's a senior figure in the royal family. He was for many years ambassador in the United States. People would say there was no foreign ambassador who knew the United States better than Bandar. He was out of favor for a while, but to be given the intelligence portfolio in Saudi Arabia, incredibly important. And if they could take him out, it means there's not a member of the royal family in Saudi Arabia who's not vulnerable. So if there's a grain of truth to this, as I say, it represents a dramatic increase in the risk of confrontation between the Saudis and Iran.
All right. Ambassador Bolton, I've worn you out. So we just have a lot to discuss, and this thing just has me crazy. Thanks so much for joining us.